That's Robin Trower in this place, bringing us back into the program, Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Lawrence Millman about his book, At the End of the World. And now the table is sort of set here. 1941, there's a meteor shower over the Belcher Islands. It's seen by the Inuits who are there. They're in a kind of a desperate situation. They see it as a sign that the world is about to end. And within a short period of time, 9 people are murdered. The people who did the killing never denied it. They even explained why they did it. It's a unique circumstances, and we're going to get into the specifics in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Stick around. So, Lawrence, pick up the story from when this meteor shower occurs, the sequence of events from there.
A fellow named Uyurak, who was or considered himself an Anyapok, which is a shaman, took it as a sign, and took it as a sign that said he, Uyurak, was Jesus. And I got much of the material in the book from Inuit elders, and the old woman who was my main informant was... She said, you know, Uyurak, he was very short. And she put her hand below my shoulder bone that indicated he was, just barely 5 feet tall. And he could have had something akin to a Napoleon complex. Napoleon tried to conquer Europe, and Uyurak became the son of God. And he turned to the best hunter, the tallest man in the Belchers, Peter Sala, and said, and Peter is God. Well, it sort of figures, you know, the tallest man and the best hunter, especially. Peter was a little bit baffled by this designation. And the curious thing about Peter is that he, of all the people there, had the most contact with the outside world. He commonly went to the mainland to pick up the mail for the Hudson Bay Company and some of the supplies. He would make 4 or 5 trips to the mainland a year, and he also had previously been a guide for a Carnegie Museum expedition in the Belchers, where he helped them collect. It was an ornithological expedition, and he helped them. He took them to places where they could collect birds. So you could say that perhaps he was a very unlikely god. He looked baffled, and he paused. He waited a few days and then came back and said, yes, I am God. This was a difficult... The elderly woman I was talking to hadn't talked about this story for 60 years. And it was very hard, in fact, when I was in the Belchers to get people, except a few elders, to talk about it. They regarded this as very embarrassing. One man said to me, by comparison, he said, if your daughter was raped, would you go around talking about it? This was part of their past that was to some extent a secret, and at least when I was writing the book, the murders were not referred to on the website for what is now called Sanikiloak rather than Belcher Islands. So in any event, I speak some Inuktitut, but I always wanted to have a local person to help me translate because there would be certain words. And we were talking to this elderly woman, and the grandson, her grandson, said to me, this is going to be very intense. What it was the first victim was a teenage girl named Sarah. She said, you're not Jesus and you're not God and you're Peter Sala. And he says, well, I'm Peter Sala on the outside, but I'm God on the inside. No, you're Peter Sala on both inside and outside. And Ullrich said, "This girl is Satan." Anyone who, in fact, didn't believe in them was Satan. And in the story, there are a plethora of Satans. The old woman who was one of my main informants burst into tears. And her grandson said, "Enough for today." Well, what happened, I went back and I talked to other people as well, was, you know, they put a Primus stove to her face, Sarah's face, and yes, they said, "This girl is Satan. We must kill her." And another teenage girl named Ekinik got into the act and dragged her out of the snow house. You have to remember, these people did not have condominiums, cottages, or anything akin. They lived in snow houses during the winter, and this was winter. In the summer, they had sod houses that they built and lived in. Anyway, Ekinik dragged Sarah out of the snow house and started beating her, with drift logs and a rifle. And then she returned to the snow house and said, "My hands are frozen from killing Satan. Will someone thaw them out for me?" And that was the first death.
So this teenage girl wouldn't back down.
She wouldn't back down. And from what I gathered, I read a bit about her. She was very feisty. She was also considered lazy. She didn't help around the snow houses. Maybe she should have. But at any rate, she spoke her mind. Unaware, of course, that the God in Jesus would use violence to establish their
to prove their point. The second person. So how long before the second person says, "Look, I would imagine a lot of people in this group are thinking, look, we've known you guys your entire lives. Suddenly you're God and Jesus." It wasn't too long before somebody else stood up to them, and it's a similar result.
One of my other informants, well, what several of them said was, you know, just agree with them. If they say, one of them said, you know, if they say that Calamount, that's white people, have six legs, then agree with him. Yes, that's true. White people do indeed have six legs. Yeah, there was the second person. They moved. There was a. I don't know if we'll get this far, but one thing I ought to mention is that if this story has anything positive about it, it means that the Inuit currently in the Belchers or Senecillac are much less religious. Much less inclined to throw away their past and embrace Christianity than a number of native villages in northern Canada and the people there. And as I discovered that it's a Sunday morning, and if it's berry picking season, rather than go to church, they will go out and pick berries. To me, that's quite healthy. Anyway, there were
the second guy.
The second guy. All right. What we have is a movement. Kitoya, he is not very happy with what's going on. Maybe he felt a little guilty that he may have felt a little responsible, because after all, he was the Bible reader. And he protested, he ended up, Peter Sala became the instigator of his demise. He was first beaten up, and he crawled back bleeding to his snow house, And the old woman who was telling me about this, she looked in the window, and he was there bleeding, reading his Bible. And then she put the Bible down, and she said a wind seemed to blow the Bible until it stalled on a certain page. I said, really? Where was it? Was it the Book of Revelation? And she looked thoughtful for a moment and said, I'm so old, I don't remember. Anyway, the next day, Peter Sala came with harpoon in his hand, and he broke down the wall of Kitoyak's snow house and pinioned him to the ground and killed him. So he was the next victim. The Bible reader, the person who, in fact, was probably responsible in his own innocent way for creating the motley of characters, God and Jesus and Satan, and bringing them into the minds of these people, was the second victim.
The third victim, it's hard to believe there'd be anybody left in the group who's going to wants to bother with denying that they're God and Jesus. Go ahead and let them be God and Jesus, but there was a third one.
Well, the third victim was the son of Kitoya, and we don't know, there's no way of knowing. None of the literature suggests anything, and none of the people I talked to knew. Did he know about his father's death? He was on another island in the Belchers. The initial killings occurred on Flaherty Island, named after, of course, Robert Flaherty. But they moved, Boyrak moved with his group to an island called Tukurak Island. It wasn't, you know, when we think of distances in the U.S., you know, something like 10 to 15 miles is nothing. You know, it's an easy commute, but this was a big distance. And the people in Tukurak Island, and including the son of the Bible reader, could have well been 1,000 miles away. And in fact, Ernie Riddle, who was the one white guy in the Belcher Islands, he was the Hudson Bay Company person, he was utterly unaware of this as it was happening. He had no idea. This was, of course, long before the days of email or even telephone, so you couldn't call up somebody or email them and say, things are really messy here. So Alec, he was the victim. And he was, you know, perhaps unaware of what was going on or what had gone on Flaherty Island. His wife, Eva, and we think that actually with some of these who have Christian names, Eva is distinctly not an Inuit name, that possibly the missionary who came in the early 30s may have started distributing white people's names to the Inuit, and those names caught on. Anyway, she told Alec, you know, be careful here. You know, he looks dangerous. And Alec approached Boyrak and said, she didn't listen to her, you are not Jesus Christ, and the world is not coming to end. Now, I should say, with respect to the end of the world, this was regarded as a positive thing because it was thought that if the world came to an end, there would be no more hunger. And, you know, you could just, you know, go and get whatever food was. It would be a kind of, and this was a kind of, what shall we say, a surreal falsification of the Bible, which, you know, would imply heaven is a world where there aren't any difficulties. So the world coming to an end and we'll all end up in heaven and there's seals everywhere and walrus as well. So anyway, he denied the divinity of Boyrak. And this was an unfortunate thing. The head guy on the island was a fellow named Karak, who was known as Big Mouth. And Boyrak went up to him after Ikpak had denied his divinity, and he said, Jesus will be coming soon, and he will not want to meet people like Ikbach. Now, here's the thing. Uriach was Jesus, but Jesus also would be coming. You know, these notions of, well, they're not duplicity. There was a very strong Inuit belief that a human could be at once a human and an animal. You could be one entity on the outside and another entity on the inside. And this made you a good hunter if you were part seal. So in any event, Uriach could be Jesus, but he did tell people shortly after the meteor shower, I am Jesus waiting, and I am waiting for the other Jesus to show up. So, you know, he could be both. And then the later event, of course, which we'll get to, where a woman who was living with Uriach, living with, in other words, Jesus, ushered people out on the ice so they could greet Jesus, a multiplicity of Jesus. Anyway, what happened after Uriach said Jesus will be coming soon and he will not want to meet people like Ikbach, Karak, big mouth, grabbed his rifle and shot Ikbach twice between the shoulder blades. And when he noticed that his victim was still moving, he put a bullet in Ikbach's head. And Uriach yelled, "Satan is dead."
Again.
Again, yes. Yes. So this was the next death. And then apparently what Ava said, and she was probably saying this to protect herself, is that her husband was a bad man. He was Satan. And then Korach, big mouth, said, "We will all sleep well tonight, for I have killed Satan."
So the next stroke is six people dying all at once, children.
Yes. And that is fearsome. I went with a fellow named Marcus. He was one of my informants. And we went to Campsall Island, uninhabited. And he didn't use a GPS to get there. He knew the landscape all around him, and he could taste the seawater and determine where he was. And so we arrived in this harbor on this deserted island, covered by, 6 inches of snow and ice. And he said, "Here, it happened here." And this was the harbor. Mina, who was Peter Sala's sister, as the old woman told me, first she was normal, then she was crazy. And she started ushering. Well, the most easily usherable of the people would be children and old people. And she started ushering them out on the ice, cracking an Inuit dog whip. And Inuit dog whips, if you crack them in the right way, they can easily take out an eye or remove an ear. So she was forcing them on the ice. It was probably around 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
I'll tell you what, Lawrence, the music is telling us we need to take a break here. When we come back, we'll tell you how six people ended up dying on the ice all at once. And then amazingly, there was a trial out there on the ice. Talking Heads, take us into the break. We'll be right back with more on Coast to Coast AM. That's from 1973's Red Rose Speedway, Paul McCartney and Wings. We're talking with Lawrence Millman about his book, At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic. We've heard about how three people were not willing to buy the story that two of their fellow inhabitants of the Belcher Islands had become Jesus and God. They denied that and were killed, murdered. Six more people died all in one swoop. We're going to get the details on that in just a moment. So Lawrence Millman, three of the people who refused to acknowledge that these two Inuit were God and Jesus were murdered. And then the sister of one of the deities decides to take matters into her own hands, starts herding people by using a whip to herd people out onto the ice, presumably to meet Jesus.
Yes, to meet Jesus. And one of the people said, well, why can't he come and meet us in our snow houses? And she said, that is not his way. And she said that once they reached a certain point on the ice, that Jesus would be kayaking down from the sky to meet them. And no one seemed to consider this bizarre or impossible, Jesus kayaking vertically, or even Jesus in a kayak. And it could be that they were so overwhelmed by fear that she could have almost said anything. Anyway, it was a cold day in March. We don't know, maybe 30 degrees below zero, and she started whipping children and elderly people out on the ice, yelling at the same time, "Come, Jesus, come!" And at a certain point, she decided that, well, we have to meet our Savior naked. So she started ripping off the clothes. It was easier to rip off the clothes of elderly people and little kids than it would have been if there were a bunch of young virile hunters and their wives. Well, there weren't. She kept her own clothes on at the same time. And finally, one or two people came to their senses and said, we've got to bring them back. They'll freeze. And she says, it won't matter if they freeze. Thinking, okay, you know, they will freeze and automatically be transported to a better place. But every single one of the six who died of hypothermia was related to God, Peter Sala, who wasn't around at that time. He had gone to the mainland and, in fact, had told the Hudson Bay Company person on the mainland that, you know, about the murders, the three murders. He was unaware of the six subsequent murders.
So God tells somebody there at the Hudson Bay Company that this has happened.
Yes.
That person calls the authorities.
That person telegraphs the authorities, and the Mounties will make a visit to the Belchers. Not very easy to do. This was toward the beginning of World War II. And I should mention, with respect to World War II, lots and lots of people died, in the millions. But if you take the percentage of people who died in the Belchers, take it as a percentage, it's a far greater percentage of people than who died in World War II. 9 out of something like 165 or 170 people died.
It takes a long time for the authorities to sort of spring into action. World War II is underway, so there are no planes to speak of. They finally sort of cobble one together. And how long is it? It's a couple of months before anybody comes there to check it out.
Well, it's a little less than that, but they do come to check it out, and all the people greet them happily, admitting the crimes. And, you know, the Mounties are coming, and they're bringing food and feeding people. And I have a feeling that they probably associated white man's justice with food, and food in a place where food was perhaps not altogether common. So the Mounties came, and I forgot to mention Peter Sala, when he came back to the Belchers and found out that his elderly mother, sister, one of his offspring, and so on, all six of them were related to them. As I say in the book, Inuit men typically don't cry, no matter how awful the circumstances. But when he heard what happened on the ice of Campsall Island, he began sobbing.
Is there any indication or hint in any of the records or journals or what was written that he decided he was no longer God after that had happened?
Or I think he decided much earlier, because if he was going with the Hudson Bay Company man, taking them to the mainland, a fellow named Ernie Riddle, and he was the guide. He was always the one who took Ernie Riddle to the mainland and back. He said, "I am a bad man." Now, if he still believed that he was God, he probably wouldn't have said, "I am a bad man." He didn't elaborate, but he did elaborate to Harold Utgarden, who was the Hudson Bay man, company man on the mainland, and who, because perhaps he was half Native himself, he had a reputation for being far more, what should we say, respectful of Native people. He was half Cree and half Norwegian. And so Peter told him, not Ernie, the true story of the three deaths. But he didn't yet know that his sister would be responsible for six more.
The Mounties eventually get there, check things out, and they realize something needs to be done. I mean, even though this is a remote place, it's still legally their jurisdiction, so they decide there's going to be a trial. And this would be quite a scene in a movie, I would think, of the, it's surreal what goes down.
Yes. Yes, well, the trial is itself quite interesting because, you know, it's Canadian jurisprudence at that time was a mixture of being supremely liberal and quite racist, if one can contemplate such a paradox. The jury consisted entirely of white people. Not a single Inuk was on the jury. There were some prospectors, iron ore prospectors, a few journalists, and one of the journalists, the old woman was telling me this, started taking photographs in this old style camera that, you know, flashed and made a loud sound. And the Inuit there were so ignorant of photography that they thought, "What is this strange? He's shooting at us." And they would duck. Every time the camera was being poised towards them, they would bend over or duck because they thought they were being shot at. So the trial took place, and accused, Akinik, there was another gentleman, there was Peter Sala and Oyerak, were all banished from the Belchers. Quarock, Big Mouth, was not. He was a great hunter, and he would look after the families of those whose breadwinners, or we could call them seal winners, had been disposed. They were exiled to the mainland, and for several of them, this is worse than execution. Imagine, this is your home, the home of your ancestors, you know, the tundra, its plants, its fungi, its insects, even its mosquitoes, they're all in your genes, and you're told you could never come back here again. It would be a fate, I think, for some more horrific than an execution.
Peter Sala, I guess, at the end of his life, does get back there. He's given
permission. Peter does get back there, and it's very interesting because he wanted to go back and be with his grandkids, members of his family, and he was not acknowledged by them. And others who know the story, but when they saw him, they would spit at him. The old woman told me, it was very moving, really, toward one of our last meetings, she said, "You know, I didn't spit at him. He had already suffered enough." And that was true.
2001, you make the trip, the arduous journey. It was still, you know, quite a trip. And 2001, you go there to collect information and interview people and put this together, what eventually becomes this book. You are there when the 9/11 attacks.
That's right.
So describe that one.
Well, you know, it was, I wasn't there with, it was, I was there when the 9/11 attack occurred, and 2 days later, an Inuk named Simeoni comes up to my tent in his snow machine and says, "I have bad news for you. New York City is no more. America may be no more too. Come, I will show you." And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So we went to, there's a sort of perpetually run-down hotel there at the Belchers in, well, everyone lives now in one village. They are no longer spread out over the islands hunting. And there were a bunch of people gathered around the TV, and they were watching, you know, the events from 2 days earlier, of, you know, a little sequence here and a sequence there. And it was very interesting. At first, I thought they were being very insensitive because one little kid was laughing and pointing to the screen and saying, "Funny, funny." And others were, one woman commented on the newswoman and said, "Well, what nice clothes she's wearing." And then one of the scenes where one of the towers falls down, someone applauded. It was like they were watching a movie. They were detached. This was a whole alien world to them. They'd never, most of them hadn't seen a tall building from before. One elder remarked, and these are lines that immediately went into my notebook, he said, and I agree with him, he said, with respect to New York City's remaining skyline, "How can people live so far above the ground?" And I often ask myself that when I travel in a large city. Anyway, I found in the end that I wasn't overly affected by watching what happened during 9/11, but I was curious as to why I hadn't been affected. And I decided that I would walk back to my tent and brood on this. You know, I looked at some of the nature around and studied the, you know, droppings of lemmings to see if there were any fungi growing on them. And I saw a snowy owl and so on. And, you know, it slowly came to me that this wasn't real. And I had been far more affected by the old woman as I was sitting with her and watching her describe the murders of 60 years ago, because it was real. It didn't occur on a screen, than I had been by watching the theoretically more tragic events of 9/11.
Tell me this, you know, 2001, there's a television there. They all live in one village instead of spread out. They don't live in snow houses. Life had certainly changed. They have, you know, there's technology that's in evidence that's changed their lives. In a sense, I guess their world did end.
Their world did end. There were still a few people were hunting. And, you know, the internet was starting to get in. One man, okay, an elder who didn't have it, asked me, what's this word that I keep hearing people, younger people use, internet? And it sounded a lot like a type of fishnet to him, but it wasn't. I had to explain to him what it was. There were some of the houses, in fact, and this was true in a lot of the places in the Arctic that I visited in the early 2000s, that had TVs but didn't have running water. So there was no bathroom, but there was a place where you could sit and watch television. That was a matter of priority. And it since has become, as it has most parts of the world that might once have been considered remote, globalized. And I'm in touch with a few people there. I mean, any type of electronic device, anything that one might have here, they might have there. Toward the end, there was one man, Talertuk, who started emailing me. And toward almost at the end of the his life, he sent me this email that, it was a very interesting email. He said, "Everyone here in Santa Kilowac, they're all going digital now, and they don't look at nothing else. Me too. Ha ha. I am, how you say it, screened in." And he ended that email with the Inuktitut word, Arjornamat. Arjornamat, which means something like, that's the way it is, or nothing can be done about it. And I think he's right. That's the way it is. For better or worse, in sickness and health, to death the worst part.
You make the point, too, that their senses change. When they rely on technology, the abilities that they once had are gone. And I guess the world that they used to live in has also changed. I know that climate change for a lot of people is a sensitive topic.
And now the most, one could, make, not accuse them of the, not say that this is particularly bad, but rap music is overwhelmingly popular now. And, anything that is popular in Las Vegas, in Cambridge, Annapolis, Maryland, could well be popular seconds later in the Belcher Islands. The identity of places changes with this type of communication until everything turns out to be the same.
And the world itself has changed. I mean, we don't like to, some people don't want to hear about climate change. It can't be real, or pollution. We can't possibly have the power to poison our planet, but you see evidence of that as well up there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I tell people who are climate change deniers or who say that climate change is a, quote, hoax, just go up to the Arctic and they can see for themselves. I've been in a couple of places where it was so unusually warm. The kids were taking off their clothes and jumping into ponds to cool off. And I mentioned to one of their parents, this was actually in East Greenland, I said, you maybe should get a lifeguard here. A lifeguard? She said, what's that? So, climate change is a reality, and that's all I can tell people.
Lawrence Millman, we're out of time. I wish we could have dwelled on that a little bit more, but there's a lot of really fascinating and profound stuff in the book. It's called At the End of the World, and I hope people will check it out. I want to thank you for being here.
And I want to thank you for this interview and asking me such good questions.
All right. We'll talk to you again. Hope you'll keep us in mind when the next project comes out. Thanks very much. We'll be back in a moment with Dawn Hunter-Clark, Paranormal Canadian Tales, here on Coast to Coast AM. Jimi Hendrix going to take us into the break with a song from 1967, The Wind Cries Mary.